time of public crisis, when the international voices sound ever more puzzled and hypocritical in the masking of their real ambitions, it is natural for even those of us who are poets to wonder about the importance of poetry. Yet, examining it again, I think, we find that after all the doubt and questioning, there is a rare quality that poetry gives us if we are willing to expose ourselves to this craft. What is this quality? Theodore Rettke wrote in an essay on identity, "Can we say this, that the self can be found in love, in human mutual love, in work that one loves, not in Arbeit in the German sense?" Think of what happened to them and is still happening. The novel, that secondary form, can teach us how to act. The poem and music, how to feel. And the feeling is vastly more important. Once we feel deeply, to paraphrase Marianne Moore, we begin to behave. It is a pleasure today to introduce two young poets who feel very deeply. Laura Ulowitz has published widely in many magazines in this country and in England. Her work is fearlessly personal in an age when poetry often seems a variety of strangely mannered masks. She is always trying to discover, I think, her most essential relation to the world. Robert Sward is another voice with a distinctly individual tone. He is a poet with a wide variety of techniques who is deeply concerned with exploring important new subject matter. His new book, Thousand-Year-Old Fiancé, will be published next month. It's a great pleasure to welcome Laura Ulowitz and Robert Sward.
I'm Laura Ulowitz, I'm not Robert Sward. The first poem I'm going to read is called As She Combed Her Hair. "Give me," he said, "something to chain you with." She said, "Seaweed and hair will do. If what you are commands my lewdest purity, you are my anchor, and I pivot round you, but not my captain, with whom I and the tides quibble. I am your shadow, fleshed and far too real, hoving above you in the sea, where, dive as you must, by noon or blacker hours, I am glued above your privacy. Now you have reached this harbor, the sea will be all you know of forever. No one will sing unless the fishes sing, or you and I raise up proud voice together in whatever weather's given. Because I love her sea, I love your land. So as you love my flesh, learn to lust after me. Learn to love even this, my strangeness. More than if I were captive mother or guide, be then my equal priest with whom I kneel. But give me," he said, "something to chain you with." The second poem is really about freedom. about finding freedom, which a good many of my poems are about. Personal freedom, I mean, not, rah-rah the flag or anything. It's called Letter 3. Page 1. Like these geraniums, that sun rises to claim us, will not be ignored, as if the sea were within us and no ark anywhere. Lie down, geraniums. So much continuous blossoming injures the eye of the heart of the beast accustomed to transience. And you, beast, panicked by weariness, soothe yourself back to magnificence. You who escaped with yourself from the ark need strength beyond that to create freedom in freedom. Page 2. Because there was no ark, some little known beast of the sea learned water from waves and rolled over the antique burden of itself. Because there was no ark, some little known beast of the sea, all common seeming. I'm sorry. May I start that again? Because there was no ark, some little known beast of the sea learned water from waves and rolled over the antique burden of itself. Because there was no ark, some delicate beast at bay, all common seeming, met the oncoming waves with hysteria. Its most grotesque movement revealed some grace. Because there was no ark, some crafty beast of a dragon built intricate castles of shell wherein it moved with the grace of chiffon, the color of saffron. Page 3. Stand where you will and think of the whales, how they'll not come ambling the Umbrian hills, or smile in your window, or nibble your grape leaves, but tunneling where they must to make their waves, or break their waves to patterns of grape leaves. They will evade you as the sea evades you. When saying, it is merely water, even the most apt sea maiden drowns. Remember their schools touring home through the sea, neither rooted nor uprooted. Unlike geraniums, the whole sea is their ark, or else they are. Yet variably orbited, placed, they too will float their massive bellies up. And should your last whale die, you'll still find left this fierce, deliberate sun which grows, from which there is no ark, or no ark suitable, till sun on the land and on the ocean sun, each summer day is a day of intolerable judgment. Now, I'd like to read one that's quite a different sort of style than those. It's a second poem from two poems. It's called Elegy for a Drunken Grandmother. There, as I said, there are two poems, and the first one, considering the Poles in Vienna who are waiting to go to America, as being naive. And this one, I'm trying to figure out how it is that I am naive compared to them. There is a quote in it from Henry James, his last words, which were, "Ah, here it is at last, the distinguished thing." And also at the beginning, a quote from Ezra Pound, "And the fish swim in the lake and do not even own clothing." Elegy for a Drunken Grandmother. What is it they've learned that I don't know? these materialists by choice. Todowitz, who wove through machine gun fire, bargaining on better wages, who bled thin on the road to Wien. Lottie, who gate-crashed the party of free enterprise. Stanislaw's dozen, who boarded the train strangers, yet in Paris claimed asylum together. The three who followed, hypnotized by daring. The homesick spy, who cannot return. And I, American and blessed, and I here exiled from my life, my proper source, my past madness. What do they know that I don't? Defeat, victory in it, that people die. I fight a feeling I have lived forever. Yet something they've known proves me a child, some difference of nation and or of kind. You have a good heart, says Todowitz, but you are naive. A woman needs a town around her, a fine clothes, perfume. To them, poverty, is death. Why are you willfully poor, says Lottie, when you have freedom? I have one subtle luxury. I can consider freedom personal. All over the earth, there is dying, but death has forgotten to come. I give all pride in having survived to these who, not for religion, have gnawed their own bellies, to these whose enemies have not been friends. I lack their superior view on suicides, heart cases, and the young who go mad and count this again, they are so amused by their inner voices. Yet barring murder, accident, and yes, disease or war, I expect to go old, able to say, ah, here it is at last, the distinguished thing. Because my grandmother moved with her clothes in a bedsheet, her children in the future, I speak in second-generation English and cannot get over loving America as my homeland. Reared by grace of parents in a then safe country, death is a private matter to me. We go, like Babush, one by one away. We seem not to return. These Poles have no concern with hypothetical heavens, neither do I. Yet it isn't true I believe myself exempt. I too, yes, I am growing toward not being. If to these more practical paranoids I seem to walk vagrant toward death, to me, these Polish men or women, they wear their coats like houses, their houses like prisons. The best of them have doors on the second floor. No. I knew an American who wore her house like a church and let everyone in. No. Our homes were bombed, says Stashek, but you were lucky. Then why does New York look more desolate than Wien? Why have I seen a land ripped up for a progress we were never sure we believed in? My mother, he says, was raped by a German madman. Oh, we get raped every day by maniacs of our own country. 30 of my comrades fell. 30 of mine committed suicide. It isn't I who want to retreat to security for many. I want to come out of hiding in a god for the select. I don't know what death is, but I can guess as well as Stashek what it isn't. I am not prepared, so I am not in a hurry. Yet it's a fault I have to think death natural. I lack community here, because they know, and I don't, that death is a mass disgrace. I balk, I scoff, I will not be baptized in the blood and the degradation of not being permitted to go there one by one. This poem is called House of Cards. I wrote it in recollection of Ransom's Equilibrist. I think you probably know the poem about the two lovers who lie side by side once they die, never having met. I was trying really, in a way, poke fun at Freud in this. The two people in it are the father and daughter rather than lovers. House of Cards. She shot her father early in her sleep. He whined as rain whines up and down a street. She had some pity, yet had no discretion, buried him in guilt and lost her reason. His ghost became her ghost, strode in her garden, clipping her hedge to sticks, begging no pardon. She ran away the world in cool confusion. Had she a right to kill before the season, before she knew him in herself or separate? He's more alive. It was herself she shot. As he once cried for loss, she cries for past, would have him round her neck again as ballast. The sticks he pruned are grown to vacant posts, though she, gone lost, came back. Now both are ghosts. Forever changing shape they never fix, forever they yearn back to those simpler sticks. Still they remain controlled, hoping to part. They play a game of cards, a game of hearts. Damned to each other, they refuse to meet. Neither can win the game because both cheat. The next poem is called The Woman Speaks as a Blackbird. Midas, I was given a gift, and the gift was this. I tasted the world with my whole free tongue, and I was in love with myself. Midas, who never learned the conditions of song, listen to this. It is the world flowing to the whole free bird, channeled by the whole tongue. Midas, I was given a gift, and the gift was this. I had a voice to sing of the world, to sing of love, to sing of myself, and I sang, though not in words. Midas, who never learned the conditions of song, listen to this. It is the world flowing through the whole free bird, channeled by the whole tongue. Midas, I was given a gift, and the gift was this. The man who most admired my voice split my tongue to give me speech. I could not sing in either language. Midas, who never learned the conditions of song, listen to this. It is the world flowing through the whole free bird, channeled by the whole town. How much time do I have? I didn't. Yeah. Most of the poems that I've been writing recently are to go in a book eventually called The Inheritance. all the poems, a lot of fairly short poems, but all related to what a person's inheritance is. First of all, obviously your inheritance is your family background. So the first section, most of what I have written so far is the first section, deals primarily with family. And then it branches out later, as it does with anyone. You grow older, your inheritance becomes friends, because the books you read, your education, your travel, you know, finally gets to be the whole world. But whatever you dare encounter of it anyway. I'll read a couple of sections, one dealing with my mother and the other one dealing with my grandparents. Michigan. No, I'll start the other way around, I think, with Pennsylvania, the grandparents. Stefan making wine from the dandelions, beer from the hops, raspberry brandy. Sophie moving among the asters, not an aster. Deft in the shade of the full plum tree, she'd chop off chicken heads, between chickens hugging me. Sophie, babush, I said, I never want to go home. Younger than guilt, I said it that soon. Nyamawa, go to sleep. Sophie, as myth, knew how to be, knew to make dill pickles, pierogi, Easter lamb cakes. I would grow up Sophie, smile a gold tooth and smell of whiskey. How they puzzled the neighbors, though, costumed as farmers. Their Slavic names buzzed a confusion of S's and Z's. Are they Wops or Polaks or Russians? What did you do in your country? No one remembered. This is our country. We own land here. We are free. We came to plow our land in peace, Panya. Something controlled behind the high cheekbones. Something the lady daughter knew and kept silent. Some reason she had for despising them and herself. It would glitter, a slyness in the eyes. Yet weekdays they worked on the factory, weekends the farm, till the land and the wages were neighbors, and the whiskey tamed them. Michigan. My lady mother of discipline would snip the ramblers, selecting the taut buds over the sprung clusters, buds hinting promise. It was her patient joy to place them in a vase to watch them open. Always they came out common, sprawling. She fed their earth. They grew more cluttered, by nines and fifteens to the bunch, those seven sisters. All one evening, she pressed one against her cheek in secret crying, because she'd forgot their name in Polish, and dug them out next day to set in tea roses, white pillars that stood up singly on thornless stalks. That winter bit them back to below the graft, that second winter. Come summer, Grandfather Stefan laughed. You buy a wilderness of briars for your garden and pay good money. She took this never as omen, but as cold lesson. Planted again, and each year mulched her roses. Nor did she travel after this, far from her will or garden, except for funerals. The last poem, which is in three sections, and is about the length of about three of those, is going to be sort of interrupted a couple of times, with the permission of the other poet and I guess everybody else concerned. Hilary Fowler and I have been doing something in in high schools. She would sing folk songs which would illustrate the poems. And then I would read. And she doesn't have her guitar with her, but we're going to do one thing, which we've done in the high schools and which we did at the art festival. This poem is called Within One Temperate Zone. And it has, as I said, three sections. The first part, well, the whole thing takes place in England. The first part and the last part are about England, about an English garden. And the center part refers back to California. I think you'd understand that from the poem, but it just helped you get a hold of it in your minds with the thing. And it also is part of the inheritance. You want to come up here? I don't know if you can be heard, though. I'm losing.
The rose in the air, beloved by the bee, thinks not of the care her root takes ceaselessly. I asked of the root, why lay it so deep? I hide content, it said, and underground to keep. To bear a rose o'erhead, the honor is mine. Though low I lie in my bed, aloft we both shine. I said to the rose, of flowers the proudest queen, you live for but an hour. The rose said, I am seen.
The beginning is an English woman speaking. This pronged twig is the chrysanthemum's disguise. These green earthworts, daffodils. Three mottled sticks with thorns. I feel wild brambles prick electric in my mind. This old lady, how she talks me her garden. Is it so single a pride, her small earth skill, that she must believe I cannot tell a sprig before it blooms the bush it will become? As if I hadn't turned raw earth before I turned to make a garden of myself. Yet give her credit. She's tact or business enough to leave me alone in her patchwork sun. I, pointy-toed, tight-skirted, gloved, what strips my fingers, drags them naked down to caress this muck too sodden yet to be worked. Is it the bones? No, the bones of those peasants are bound, as once their bodies were, to this earth we migrate over. Kinship of marrow? Hey, you in there, old Pollock, patriot, you who stole what the bees wanted to suck. Here I am, and what do you think of your great-great-granddaughter? But this old lady comes back to point out spring. One snowdrop hidden behind a vine, six lean petals. She hands me spring. And suddenly, I belong nowhere, being owned by no plot of ground. And that over there, that flitting over the back fence like a gypsy, like bird shadow. Surely we have those tragedies we plan, but today the bones do blame that. Tell me it is a trick of peasant skulls, on the mind's free choosing, that given one drop of spring, I jabber of furrows and seed, like a blackbird hopping stubborn after a farmer. Mm-hmm. Oh, dear. I don't think so. Oh, the South Coast, the wild coast and lonely, you may win at a game in Halone, but the lion still rules the barrancas, and a man there is always alone. Oh, the South Coast, the Wild Coast, and lonely.
Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang.
But the lion.
Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang.
And a man.
My friend, the witch doctor, he told me what to do. My friend, the witch doctor, he told me what to say. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
The lion still rules over the Uncas, and the man there is always alone. Well, that really does describe the next part of the poem, California. It wasn't on the map. Heat stalled the car at the valley or the base of the 10th hill. Lost. A post office said the town of San Sindula, not on the map. I asked Carl, who do you suppose has ever climbed that hill? In 1,000 years, maybe one Indian, a ranch hand after cattle, a bull after a cow. Two boys in black jeans leaned against a log fence, playing a pocket radio and cursing loud to beat the vastness down. A matter of will and hot jazz. I said, it's pretty tame here, being, of course, wrong. I might have meant too wild with people. And so we climbed until the car should cool, more to escape noise than to discover. That seconded the wrong. Yet pausing for breath on the ascent, Carl told me how on his mother's grave in Concord, while drunk, he first made love to another man in Concord, where the hills are monumented with hawthorn, Melville, Walden Pond, and our first revolution for severance, the fought one. Now we looked eastward across a namelessness of hills, for beyond this one was another equal in size, and beyond it another, until our minds, wanting somewhere to fix, were trapped in freedom. Often I dream I open 100 doors, and behind each door, there is only another door.
I said to the rose of flowers, the proudest queen, you live for but an hour. And the rose said, I am seen.
But this garden is, and it is temperate. Really so, like its lady. The dangers in it are subtle, unless you know it too well, so that moving in a world of, say, nasturtium, the slightest missing margin of a leaf jars your whole gardener's being with the same old message of kill and be killed. If tom-toms in you roams and dinosaurs, sounds the drum roll of your own death. I said the garden is temperate. I mean tempered, tampered with, more than the weather. No buzzards circle you, no lions gorge. Lawnmowers, not deer, not even goats crop its short grass. A wolf has not been seen here for 500 years. I think 1,000 people have walked through and never left the path. Yet still, so many centuries off from wilderness or field, crabgrass and plantain are stubborn to crowd out her alien turf where predatory slugs and beetles crawl. What I admire is how her roses seem to lean out of the wall of their own accord, and how, when people tell her, what a lovely garden, meaning temperate, something wry in her rests. She tucks away the tools of tending it and smiles, talking of origins and love of flowers, as if the garden had been given her, not made. Thank you very much.